Over a decade ago, Matias created a startup to take home maintenance services online. IguanaFix expanded across Latin America and eventually attracted the Brazilian unicorn Madeira Madeira. After the sale, Matias dove into a new challenge, bringing more efficiency to the U.S. real estate market. Keyway uses data science, artificial intelligence, and machine learning to improve how Americans manage investments in commercial properties. In this episode, Matias and I talk about whether it's harder to operate a startup in the U.S. or in LATAM, his company building lessons, including how to efficiently use AI in your startup, and how to divide roles between co-founders. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos LATAM. Matias, I'm glad we can reconnect here because, if I'm not mistaken, we are part of the same kind of Endeavor class. You remember, we were both going through the Endeavor process in Madrid. Is that right?
You're right. We were both selected Endeavor entrepreneurs in that ESP. So that's awesome.
That's right. I actually almost didn't get selected. They had to do a double take on me because there was one panelist who was holding out on me. Fortunately, another Argentine for me saved the day. And I got kind of bailed out there where Martin went to bat for me and convinced the other panelists. Anyways, it's part of the journey.
Great entrepreneurs recognize great entrepreneurs. So, you know, it's like Martin saw what was going on in there and he jumped in. So that makes me happy.
Yeah, it's good. So I got bailed out by another Argentine, thanks to your brethren there.
You know, we do what we can. We can't really control inflation, but it is like we're good at other things.
That's right. Well, listen, it's great to have you on. First of all, as a little background, your last company, IguanaFix, the one that you were admitted to Endeavor as an Endeavor entrepreneur, and I think that was like 2016?
2016, yeah. We started that company probably like late 2013, but 2016, we were selected Endeavor entrepreneurs. And I think that year we were like entrepreneurs of the year in Argentina or the year after, which was exciting too.
Yeah. You guys sold the company and now you started another company. Well, first of all, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with us?
I like pain.
Yeah, exactly. So why are you back for more pain, Matias?
Yeah. I think you get addicted to the pain. Look, in full reality, I wasn't thinking about starting a new company when I started Keyway. IguanaFix was in the real estate sector as well. You know, we were solving the pain point around home improvement services in Latin America. So we were very close to real estate and real estate transactions. And I just, when I exited IguanaFix, I just started talking with, you know, every smart person I could about real estate and what was wrong with real estate transactions and why they were hard and how technology could change it. But it was a little bit more of an intellectual exercise. And one of those conversations, I met my co-founder, Sebastian, that had been at Google for almost a decade, managing teams of machine learning engineers, and he was excited about solving that problem. And then we randomly met this advisor that used to be the head of real estate for BlackRock, and he was excited about helping us. And then we just started spending more time getting smarter about that market, and then we were like, hey, there's a problem here we're actually excited to solve. And, you know, I jumped in the pool again. But as you said, you know, once you jump in the pool, there's a lot of excitement. There's also a lot of pain that you have to deal with. And once you exit a company, you only remember the nice, you make up a story that's very linear and sounds great. But, you know, the reality of entrepreneurship is, you know, there are more hiccups in the middle that you deal with.
I was hosting a group of entrepreneurs who were part of what I call the Breakfast Club. It was a handful of entrepreneurs that I used to meet with in Sao Paulo, guys from Dr. Consulta, Pitsy, baby.com.br, and then Nubank. David didn't make it this weekend, but the other guys did. And one of the founders, Daniel from Pitsy, he has a little baby. And the whole weekend, the baby's just so cute and you're kind of holding it and you're getting all the smiles. And as a parent, my kids are 10 and 8 now. And I remember when you have the first one and you're getting ready to have the second baby, you forget about the middle of the night waking up and the challenges that come along with being a parent of a new baby. And I think that
entrepreneurship is a bit like that. You kind of block out the hard moments, and they're just over. I think they kind of the amazing moments definitely like carry more weight, and therefore you're just kind of fixate on that. So that's probably a little bit of what's happening with you. But how's it going so far? Tell us how long you've been operating, and then let's talk a little bit more. I want to go back a little bit into some of the challenges and learnings of IguanaFix, but maybe give us a quick overview of, you know, what the problem you're solving is and what are the opportunities that you're excited about with respect to Keyway.
Yeah, so at Keyway, basically, we're changing the way which real estate transactions are done in the U.S. There's a huge opportunity to leverage AI and machine learning to help source, underwrite, transact, and manage real estate across the globe. I think we're in a unique, we're living in such an exciting time with AI. I think like AI is like, you know, it's like we're like in the 1997 of the internet. You know, there's a lot of hype around it, but also a huge opportunity. And we're basically using, you know, thousands of data points to help us identify interesting real estate opportunities, price them quickly, and then leveraging AI to smooth out the transaction and reducing the cost of transacting by 50% and the time that it takes to buy a building by over 50%. So just like very exciting times. We've raised around $40 million of venture capital money. We have an amazing team of 50 people, folks from the real estate team that come from places like Blackstone and Goldman Sachs, and then a technology and data science team that's helping us really reinvent the way in which real transactions are made and managed.
So this is the commercial real estate space. When people talk about prop tech, there's so many pieces of prop tech, right? You've got residential sales, you got rental market, you've got the kind of short-term rentals, long-term rentals, you've got mortgage, you've got so many different pieces to the, and then the commercial real estate space has predominantly been dominated by a handful of players, CoStar being kind of the biggest of them all in the US. And I remember they acquired LoopNet back in the day, which was more of the marketplace, and then they had the data company. Sounds like you're focusing on the transaction. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what was the insight that you had? Was it just the revelation that AI allows for more efficiency, or what was the key insight where you're like, oh, wow, this is an opportunity?
Yeah, the key insight was that today it takes the same amount of time and effort to close a $5 million deal than a $200 million deal. So when you look at the institutional investors, they're focused on large deals because it makes sense, right? And it's just like if I'm going to put a number of associates and a VP and a bunch of people to look at CoStar and just like to find a deal and close a deal, I'm just going to focus on really large deals. And what we saw is a complete lack of liquidity and data on the smaller deals. And we just saw a super interesting opportunity to partner with these institutional investors and tell them, hey, with the data we're creating and the visibility we're creating and by making the transactions much more efficient, we can bring this institutional view to smaller scale commercial real estate and apply, you know, the same level of insight, the same level of analysis to the smaller deals. Fast forward a little bit, and then what we're seeing now is this tool that we build to source, underwrite, and transact these assets is like very valuable. And what we're seeing is a huge opportunity to become a verticalized SaaS platform to transact these smaller deals. And just like AI makes just like a huge difference in allowing us to do that.
So tell me about the first couple weeks of the decision. Okay, we're gonna put our energy into this. How long was it from the transaction of IguanaFix? You sold to Madera. And I mean, you were in the real estate space, yeah. But you weren't, I mean, you were IguanaFix, I wouldn't call it a real estate. Tell me more about the kind of the timeline from the transaction. Was there any deal where you had to stick around? The Madera folks kind of keep you in the mix. What was that like? Maybe go back a little bit to those days and we'll start going backwards and then we'll circle back into Keyway right now and then talk about where you're going with it.
Yeah. So kind of like after we sold to Madera, I stayed for a bit as an advisor, but not in a full-time position. I think when you're exiting a business, that's part of that decision you need to make. It's just like, do I want to work in a larger corporation for a while? You know, sometimes there are earnouts, and you know, it's a little bit of a personal decision. In my case, you know, I was ready to move forward to my next step. So I stayed as an advisor, and our COO stayed running that operation within Madeira. I moved to the US, I moved back to the US, and I started doing a couple of things. I started working as an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard University, basically helping students that were thinking about launching their ventures, you know, think through this entrepreneurial path. And that gave me exposure to a lot of like people that were starting businesses. And I was very excited to advise them, but it was just like, you know, when you're there, you're like, I should be doing something too. This is really fun. And so, you know, it was great because I was like able to help a bunch of people launch their ventures. Some companies are now live, but I also was like, I just like feel like I need to do something else. And you know, that was the time when I started just like talking to more people about real estate. As you said, at IguanaFix, we were much more on the maintenance part and facilities management part of real estate. And that's, you know, just like that's business where there's huge opportunity. It's also a very operational business, you know, just like where at the end of the day, it's like hundreds of thousands of people that are going to people's homes or people's offices to fix stuff. And I was just like getting more interested in the fintech aspect and the transaction of real estate. So I started just like, you know, doing research, getting to know people. And then at a certain point, I was like, all right, there's like this problem of aggregating smaller assets that I think is really interesting. And I think no one has cracked it. And I think there's just like a good opportunity for us.
What was that ideation process? So you're helping other entrepreneurs, and then there's this kind of real estate interest. Are you just having conversations with people in real estate? Are you talking to commercial brokerages? Are you talking to agents? Are you talking to investors? What was your ideation process like as you did discovery?
All of it. In the middle of the pandemic, you know, in the summer of 2020 with Sebastian, my co-founder, we probably interviewed over 400 brokers in the small scale commercial real estate sector. We talked with dozens of investors in the sector. We interviewed large investors in large funds. We met with people that were working in the single family rental sector, where there has been more innovation, I would say, than in commercial real estate in general. So at the beginning, it was a lot around really understanding the market, really understanding the pain points for brokers, the pain points for sellers, the pain points for buyers, the pain points for institutional investors, without a super clear thesis of how we were going to solve it. We approached it, I would say, with a very humble mind, which was, hey, transactions are happening in exactly the same way in which they were happening 60 years ago. Why is this? What's happening? How can technology change it? But in this case, we did not start with thesis first. We started with mapping the market, understanding pain points, and then figure out where technology could make a difference. And if there are a bunch of smart people out there, why hadn't this changed yet? And what was a catalyst for change?
How long did it take you from those first ideas of, okay, commercial real estate or real estate in general, conversations to get to a product? And did you raise capital in order to kind of build the product? Did you bootstrap it? Did you, you know, talk us through the kind of fundraising process in order to get to market with what you were building?
We bootstrapped it at the beginning because without a clear idea of what we wanted to build, we didn't want to just raise money and commit with a particular business model. So we spent, I'll say, around 4 to 5 months just really understanding the market and figuring out, again, pain points, testing a couple of things, you know, doing like small transactions with like friends and family to run through the transaction process ourselves before we pinpointed what problem we wanted to solve. When we figured out, kind of like, we're a lot of the friction was happening, which was in the analysis of the investment and then on the transaction and coordination of the asset purchase itself, that's when we were like, there's like a very clear problem here. Let's actually raise capital to build an MVP. But we start transacting without any technology, without any product, very manually. And I think there's a lot of value on that. I'm just like, hey, do things the same way they're doing today. Go through a process yourself and understand where the pain is and, you know, how you can make it different rather than starting with it from a very conceptual standpoint.
So a lot of this talk about AI, what I'm seeing is a lot of these companies are just leveraging AI to increase efficiency, right? There has to be some kind of validation of a pain and a problem first, because AI, you can't just sprinkle on AI dust and then make it better. So is the company, how are you using AI? Why is it an AI company, or is it a company facilitated by AI? Talk me through that.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you know, it's like, I think with AI, with a lot of talk about AI, at the end of the day, it's just like, it's the same thing that for every startup is, you know, how is your solution better than the alternative that's out there? And can you create barriers of entry for the solution you're building? Because at the end of the day, you know, everyone can use ChatGPT or Bird or another version of you know, like a language processing AI model. So it's like you need to be solving a real problem. What we're doing at Kiwi is we're doing taking a lot of data that's disaggregated, and we're using AI to standardize and normalize that data and being able to derive insights from that data. So it's a lot around, can you access data that other people can't? Can you look at data more creatively? Can you assign different data sources to the same data node so you can enrich that data and understand much more about, in our case, what's happening at a specific property, what's happening in a particular block, what's happening in a particular submarket? Can I figure out whether a neighborhood is gentrifying before it actually gentrifies? Can I figure out that there are some pockets of trouble in a city before the market sees that? So there's a lot around the ability to understand, normalize, and derive insights from thousands of data points that previously could not have talked to each other. And by using AI, you can just like have this like amazing merge of data and see how all variables play with each other. And then there is another aspect of the AI, which is, can we train the system and the model to follow a specific process to coordinate between lawyers, brokers, tenants, buyers, and sellers, and basically do the job that generally a real estate associate will do in a much more efficient way. One is just like deriving analysis, and the second one is like, can you do stuff more efficiently by training the system to run the process and generally a person will run and understand documents, you know, the same way that a person will understand documents and find, you know, just like challenges or opportunities in that process.
So who are the customers primarily? How do the different players interact with you in this process? Is it investors? Is it the actual brokerages that are executing these deals? How do you interact with the market?
Yeah. Our main customers are real estate investors. So we work with family offices and institutional funds that want to build portfolios of assets. And basically, we build a buy box for them. Let's say you want to build a portfolio of small-scale multifamily buildings in the Sunbelt state with a certain return profile. We define that for them, and then we go out and we execute and we aggregate portfolios for those investors. In that process, we're interacting with owners of real estate, because sometimes we're going after deals that are off market. We're interacting with brokers, because sometimes it's listed properties. We're interacting with lawyers that participate on the transactions, but the main customers that we're serving are the investors.
So are you packaging the opportunities and then you're also executing transactions?
Exactly. Right now, we're in the process of starting to offer just a technology platform to investors as well. So we started by providing a full turnkey solution. And right now, we're starting to offer two alternatives. One is you have a view of the market and you need a partner to execute that view of the market for you. And we can do that. We'll put our real estate team on and we'll execute the transactions on your behalf. The new service that we're providing is you may want to do this yourself. And what we've realized is that, well, the platform we built initially transacts, it's a little bit of a Bloomberg terminal for commercial real estate transactions where you can have real-time access to anything that's going on in this market. So in the same way in which, you know, with a Bloomberg terminal, two hedge fund managers may decide to be on different sides of the same transaction, with our terminal, two different real estate investors may decide to be on different sides of the same transaction, or they may decide to deploy very different theses to go after in the real estate market.
Matthias, I was, as I said before, I was hanging out with some friends this weekend, other entrepreneurs from LATAM. In this case, I was chatting with Tomas Seroji, who is the founder and chairman of Dr. Consulta, a big health tech company in Brazil. And he actually asked me a question, and I'm going to ask you the same question. He said, is it harder to build in LATAM or the US? And my response, I'll tell you my response in a second, but I haven't actually built much in the US. And so you historically had a business focus in Argentina, expanded to Brazil. I think you're in Uruguay, Mexico. So you had a lot of exposure building businesses in LATAM, and now you're building a US focused startup. What are the main differences you see as an entrepreneur that's been in both markets? And what are the challenges and opportunities that you identify in each market?
Yeah. So first, let me tell you one big observation is Latin American talent is awesome. So, you know, a lot of our development and data science team is based in Latin America. So it's like I've kept a leg in Latin America as I build a company in the US. I think just like the level of like technology expertise and amazing talent that we see in Latin America is just like compares, you know, to the best people in the US as well. I will say one of the big differences is the US market is very deep. You can build a multi-billion dollar company and never leave Texas. You know, just Texas is the size of, it's just like the Texan economy is the size of the Brazilian economy. So that creates a huge opportunity to become very focused on solving a very specific problem and still being able to create a multi-billion dollar company, being extremely focused on just like a little problem. I think in Latin America, you just need to go a little bit broader in general. You know, in fintech, you may need to create kind of like a bank, like Nubank, instead of just like solving a very specific problem. It's just like the market is a little bit less deep. I think in Latin America, I think a lot of companies have leapfrog technology, but you still have a little bit of an advantage on seeing what's happening in the US, what's working, what's not working, what's happening in China, what's happening in India, what's working, what's not working, and tropicalizing that idea. I think many times this idea of like tropicalizing a business concept gets killed. It's like, oh, this guy is just like copycat this other company in the US. I think that's a huge simplification. I think just like understanding things that have worked from, it was like leveraging technology in the US market and applying that to Latin America, that's creating a whole new company. But you have a lot of information from what has happened in the US that you've taken inspiration from. I'll say on the recruitment of people, the US has, leaving aside developers, just like bringing people that are more kind of like industry experts and taking them to the startup world. I think a lot of people in the US are more open to that. You know, we have people that, you know, that were making 20 times more money than they're making with us on a cash basis by working at a large real estate fund. And they're willing to jump into an early stage startup because they've seen that working. I think in Latin America, we've seen different degrees of success in the startup world, some tremendously successful companies, but also the ecosystem is pretty young. So a lot of seasoned executives, you know, will take a while before they take a leap of faith on an early stage startup. So I would say recruiting senior talent may be a little easier in the US. And last but not least, I think, you know, there's more availability of capital in the US. There are, you know, thousands of early stage VC firms. you know, growth, VC, private equity. So if you're scaling and you have a good solution, the capital markets are much more fluid than in Latin America. I think companies, you know, it's like funds such as yours are really helping change that in Latin America. But, you know, it is in general harder to raise money. That also means that once you have money and you have good product market fit, you have much less competition around. And so, you know, it's like, I wouldn't say one is better than the other. I would say there are kind of like a lot of like pros and cons in each of them.
So if I can recap, probably the competitive landscape is less intense in Latin America. There's a lot of talent. US, there's more kind of, it's a more liquid market and you can be a really big player by focusing on a smaller niche. And in Latin America, you've got to kind of go either broader or more regionally focused so that you can kind of build a meaningful size business. Is that kind of a good summary?
That's exactly right.
I'd love to hear more about the lessons you have when you apply. Like, what are the biggest lessons that you have from IguanaFix that you're carrying with you as you build this new company?
Oh, so many, man. You know, it's like so many mistakes along the way, and so many mistakes were, you know, it's like still making. But say big lessons. One is not scaling too much before you have product market fit. At IguanaFix, we just like pivoted a number of times our original idea because rather than doing a ton of research at the beginning, we went on and like launched a product and we started pivoting on top of that. I think it's just like you go fast to market, test a product, but stay very lean and nimble on the early days until you understand exactly what problem you're solving. I think that's one. Just like the early days, staying nimble. We did that at Keyway and it made a huge difference. Like as a founder, stay very close to the problem. You know, don't build layers of management. Don't outsource this just like truly understanding of the problem. I think that's one learning. I think, you know, Elon Musk is amazing. Some people have different opinions, but one thing that he really does is like he stays close to the actual problem and the actual product. And I think that's critical as an entrepreneur. The second thing, and we lived through this in IguanaFix a number of times, you know, just like having 3 months of cash, 6 months of cash, having to raise a round really fast. It's just like you're growing fast, but cash flow really matters. So this idea of the market is not always open to raise money, I think it's very important. And just like making sure that as you get excited about your company, you're managing runway, that's definitely critical. And with that comes unit economics. You know, we're all entrepreneurs are hopeful. So we're always like, oh, the unit economics will make sense at scale. But really understanding the levers of unit economics, I think is critical. Last but not least, I would say just like keep it exciting, you know, just like there are so many issues that come in when you're scaling startups. It's so hard, you know, the highs are high, but their lows are so low and so painful. So just be excited about the problem that you're solving and how it's relevant. You know, at IguanaFix, we were making more efficient the home improvement sector. But while we were doing that, we were coordinating over 100,000 people that were basically accessing jobs through us. We brought tens of thousands of people to a formal economy. We trained tens of thousands of people. Tens of thousands of companies were built on the backbones of our platform. And that is just like, that was really exciting. You know, just like we were like making huge changes in people's lives, and regardless of the economic output after that, I think just like being in love with the problem you're solving and being excited by it, it's super important. I think it's just like if money is your only motivator, things can get old really fast and it can get frustrating really fast. So always thinking about why is this exciting? How will the world will different if I crack these? How will this unlock value for people? and staying in a positive frame of mind is super important.
What was the tipping point for you to sell the company?
I think at that point in time, realizing that we needed better distribution. We needed a partner that could help us distribute our products and our services much more efficiently. The alternative was raising a larger round and building those distribution channels ourselves. But we realized that we had built a really good product that was working very well. And what it needed was broader distribution. And you know, when you have someone that already has the customers that need that service, then your cost of acquisition is zero, and that company is much more valuable on top of that platform because it becomes pure margin. So it's just like, you know, after 7 years or so of running that company, it was like, do we want to raise more money and do this for 7 more years, or you know, do we couple this platform with a platform that already has the customers that we're going after and combine them in a powerful way?
How long was the transaction? How long did it take from first conversation to closing?
I'll say around a year and a half. I think that's another learning. You know, when you're going through, and this was not the only company we were talking to, and this is not the first time we were considering exit. And Brian, you have a ton of experience on this, so we'll love your thoughts. But it took a long time, and it was, you know, about to fall through several times where we were having those conversations, not only with Madeira, but also with others. So I think just like so critical to stay focused on running your business, even if you're thinking about an exit. Just like your main job as a founder and as the CEO of a company is to run a successful business. I think if a great exit comes along, entertain it, spend time, but like don't lose your focus on just like running your company and making sure that you're providing the best potential service to your customers.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to balance when you're, because it does require a lot of energy.
Yeah.
I was lucky with VivaReal because when we went into our transaction, I was the chairman and then Lucas, my partner, was the CEO. And so he was really focused on the operations. I freed time up for him to keep focusing on that, so we didn't keep our eye off the ball. But so it's, sometimes it helps to have kind of an external and an internal person. Sometimes there's that role at some of these companies where I'm not a big fan of the co-CEO model, but if you do have something similar to that, one person should be kind of the external person and the other person fundraising, capital raising, M&A conversations, all that stuff. And then you need to have someone that's just on the operations. But it is hard to balance. And 18 months is like about how long it took us. And it's definitely a roller coaster.
Yeah. And let me piggyback on something you said around kind of like your co-founder. I think that was another one of my learnings at IguanaFix and something that I applied in Keyway. It is challenging to find a good co-founder that has complementary skills, but once you have one, what a gift that is. Andres, who was my co-founder at IguanaFix, you know, he was the CTO, and just like knowing that like tech was in amazing hands and someone that was equally invested in the company as I was such a gift, and having kind of like that, the ability to share the good times, share the tough times is so important. And very similarly, Sebastian, my co-founder at Keyway now, he's the COO. He also leads our product. And this just like bringing complementary skills and with someone that's completely aligned with what you're building, I think it's just like so important. So it's not for everyone, but for me, it's just been a great experience to have a co-founder. I think having complementary skills within co-founders and different interests is also important. But I can see how that was super helpful when you were dealing with a transaction as well.
Yeah, one thing that was kind of missing a lot of my journey was having a really strong CTO from the very beginning, and that was cause of many headaches over the years. And so as I build Latitude, we have a fund, but we also have a bunch of products that we build. And Yuri Danilchenko, who was the CTO of a Kazakh-backed company in Brazil, it was a requirement that we would have someone as a co-founder that had these skills, because it was just such a pain over the years because we didn't have the full confidence. And I mean, we worked with some great CTOs, don't get me wrong, and they were awesome. But at the same time, I think the key point you make is that you need to have someone that's waking up every single day with that obsession of making sure the tech and the product is just on point. And you can hire that, but it's different when there's a co-founder that's kind of birthing this.
Yeah. And if it's not your co-founder, I think I'm a big fan. Just like your CTO needs to be on all of the important conversations. Your CTO needs to be close to the customers. Your CTO needs to understand what's going on in the business. What are the things that move the business? I think otherwise you run the risk of just like, oh, just implement this solution. And I think you're missing out on bringing on your CTO as a thought partner to come up with a solution. I think many companies or many startups fail at that. They see tech as more of like the implementation of the idea. And I think tech for a tech company is just like at the core, at the heart of what you're building. So if it's not your co-founder, it's just like bring that CTO as a co-founder and just like involve them on the critical conversations and make sure that they're staying close to the customers, close to a problem. Because that's, I think, just like that's so correlated with success.
Yeah, 100%. Any final advice that any founders listening to us looking to succeed in scaling their startups? And I love how you focused on the impact at IguanaFix. And what are your thoughts to close out here?
One is, I would say, make sure you're solving a problem that excites you. Make sure you're in love with a problem that you're solving. Make sure you stay nimble and close to that problem. Make sure that you're working with people that you respect, that are not just saying yes to what you're saying, but that you can have healthy conflict and build a culture where the best idea wins. Most of the time, you won't have all of the right answers. So you just need to have amazing people, trust them, and create that level of healthy discussion. And I'll say last but not least, you know, don't congratulate yourself too much when things are working well, because it means that probably the market is hot and you're being a little lucky, and that's great. Take advantage of that. But also when things get hard, don't beat yourself too much, because probably the market dynamics and lack is also playing a role. So, you know, just like stay focused on solving the problem. I think just like make sure that you're building towards a sustainable company. It's okay to lose money in the early days. You know, that's what VCs are for, but make sure that you have a view of the world in which this company is going to be profitable, because I think that's what allows you to survive the ups and downs of the market.
I think it was well said by a seasoned entrepreneur, as you just reframing what you said. Keep the highs not so high and the lows not so low. And that comes with experience, right? Because the swings are so dramatic, especially I feel like as a first-time entrepreneur, it's so easy to get caught up in the emotional roller coaster of your best day and your worst day are the same day. But if you, as experience kind of tells you, things are never as good as you think and things are never as bad as you think. And if you can kind of be a little more even-keeled in that way, it'll probably give you staying power so that you can, you know, continue to execute over a long period of time, because these things take decades a lot of times. They take 10 plus years to really, I think that there's an inflection point. It's funny that your business was 7 years. In my mind, 7 years is like the magic number where there's typically an inflection point after 7 years. At least I'm telling that since I'm about 3.5, 4 years in. So I'm kind of gearing my mind, but I've observed it in other companies that I've either invested in or friends' companies. And there's something kind of magic about that 7 year mark where like you really hit an inflection point. And so sometimes it happens earlier, sometimes it takes longer, but that's kind of what I've seen the most. So I think that those were wise words from a seasoned entrepreneur, that you got to keep it kind of not get too high, not get too low.
Yeah. I mean, celebrate the wins for sure. You know, it's like, I think celebrate the wins is important, but yeah. Maintaining sort of like a clear view of what you're trying to build and not let the swings of the market or some great news or some like really bad news take you out of the game.
That's great, man. Mati, thanks a lot. It's cool to see an entrepreneur from LATAM building such a competitive market in a big market, leaving the local. We need more case studies of entrepreneurs thinking really big and building big businesses in big competitive markets. So congrats on this. I know you got a long way to go still, but it sounds like you're off to an amazing start and excited to see where Keyway goes. And thanks for sharing a little bit more about your experience.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Brian. It's always great to talk to you. And I love staying close to Latin America. And I'm so excited about everything that's going in there. And just like the amazing companies are being created every day and the amazing entrepreneurs that you know you're bringing to a table through your platform and in your podcast.
Thank you, man.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth. Vamos Latam. See you next week.